So, having promised all this, having congratulated Kardama and assuring him that his life is on the verge of perfection and he's going to enjoy so many benefits of his austerities, he disappears. According to Jiva Goswami, disappearance of Vishnu should not be considered a separate incarnation. He says, well, if you want to use, you know, also consider under the term incarnation, avatar, every time the Supreme Lord appears to anybody in a vision, okay, you can do that, but it's not the ordinary use, it's not the way the words are usually used. That's Jiva Goswami's comment. If we go by the common, the conventional use of the word avatar, it's when the Lord actually descends to the earth. Either he has parents or there's some way that he makes his appearance and he stays here for some time and he goes back. It's not just some momentary or, you know, for a few minutes appears to someone and then rushes back to Vaikuntha. That's not normally called an avatar. So this is not, according to the way the word avatar is usually used, this appearance of Lord Vishnu is not an avatar, it's just a personal realization, a vision, audience granted to Kardama Muni. He's called Pratyagaksha. Yes. Was this appearance to Kardama predicted?
Yeah,
like somewhere. Well, it's mentioned in the second, at least twice in the first cantos of the Bhagavatam. That's after the fact. That's yes. Okay. I mean, it's not really a prediction because Sutta Goswami, or rather Shukadeva is speaking much, you know, 5,000 years ago, much after Kapila, but he does mention Jagye Chakara Namagrihe Nanu Devahutyam, that the Lord appears as the son of Devahuti. Because this happened in the Satyuga, I don't know what scriptures we have, you know, we can identify as going back to Satyuga that was mentioned. But it's mentioned in the Bhagavatam, other Puranas. Maybe somewhere in the Vedas there might be a mention of Kapila Muni, I'm not sure. There are too many avatars to announce them all. You know, Prabhupada mentions that Lord Vishnu appears in every single species of life. So, I mean, the Bhagavatam describes 30 or 40 incarnations at the most. And if there's one for every species, that means we're missing, you know, several million, 8 million incarnations that the Bhagavatam doesn't mention. So in the shastras that we have any access to, all the avatars can't, you know, even a fraction of the avatars can't be mentioned. But what you can take as a criterion, if you want to, you know, you need shastric evidence to judge whether someone's a real avatar or not. You could learn from studying about the avatars who are described how an avatar is supposed to behave. What are the symptoms of an avatar? And thus, when Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya met Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, although he was a Mayavadi, and he didn't want to accept that Lord Chaitanya was Krishna, he said, no, come on, there's no incarnation, there's no avatar in Kali Yuga. Vishnu is Triyuga. He doesn't appear in Kali Yuga. So he refused Gopinath Acharya, who was actually, Gopinath Acharya is also Vishnu Tattva. I forget which, he's a, who? He's one of the Amshas of Vishnu, Gopinath Acharya. He's not even a Jiva. He was preaching to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's uncle, you know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who's Krishna. You have to accept that. He wouldn't, philosophically. But when he saw the ecstatic symptoms in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he knew that this is not an ordinary person. Yeah, and his mind started to change. So there are, you know, someone who really knows the Shastra, when he meets an avatar, he's going to say, wait, you know, I don't know about this one, and there isn't supposed to be any in Kali Yuga, but he's got all the symptoms of an avatar according to the way they're described in the Shastras. someone's learned it, even if it's a Mayavadi, you'll have to recognize that something's going on there. So Vishnu talked to Kaurava, which is something wonderful in itself, and then he promised to become his son. This is only possible because of Kaurava's pure devotion. Atakshi Krishna Namadi Nabavigrayamindriya. Material senses and material mind can't even begin to realize the personality of Godhead. What to speak of making him appear in front of you and agree to have a personal relationship with you. You can't even begin to realize the Lord in your heart, as the yogis try to, without with material senses of mind. You cannot. When your senses, when your tongue and other senses become disposed to serving the Lord, to engaging in devotional service, only then can you actually begin to realize him as a person. The jnanis and the yogis, brahmavadis, they have some kind of realization, but not personal realization. They can realize the Lord's impersonal aspect, his perfection, his eternality, but they can't realize his personal glories. The yogis can have some realization of Paramatma, but they can't. That Paramatma is simply standing in their heart, like the deity on the altar, that we cannot understand. You know, we can see the deity, but we cannot fully realize that that's Krishna directly. We think a statue is standing there, not doing anything. So the yogis see the Supersoul, maybe, if they're advanced enough, but that Supersoul doesn't do anything. The pastimes, the activities, the personal reciprocations, loving reciprocations of the Lord with his devotees, that can only be realized when there's devotion. So Kaurava is, not only is he already liberated, but obviously he's already a very advanced devotee of the Supreme Person. He has love of God. Yatatam api siddhanam kashchin mam vidhi tatvata. Out of many thousands of men, one may strive for perfection. And out of many thousands of such persons who are trying to make spiritual advancement, just one might know me as I am in my personality. Okay. Anything? There's a couple. Okay. Some description how I'll skip over the next two versions. I'll just read the translations. While the sage stood looking on, the Lord left by the pathway leading to Vaikuntha, a path extolled by all great liberated souls. The sage stood listening as the hymns forming the basis of the Samaveda, vibrated by the flapping wings of the Lord's carrier, Garuda. Then, after the departure of the Lord, the worshipable sage Kaurava stayed on the bank of Bindu Sarovara, awaiting the time of which the Lord had spoken. So, what do? Krishna's disappeared. We've got 2 days, so this continues his meditation for another 2 days. Just patiently waiting. Tatenu kampamsu samikshamana. This is the business of a Madhyama Adhikari. What's his primary responsibility? Is to be patient. Tatenu kampamsu samikshamana. Be confident. You've been promised the mercy of Krishna, but you have to wait a little while until you become fully qualified to take it. Like a young man, father has passed away, and he's got the estate promised to him, but he has to come to a certain age before he can receive his father's inheritance. So the Madhyamadhikari has to make further advancement before he can get actually realize the full mercy of the Lord, but it's promised to him. So therefore, the tatenu kamsam kampam, you familiar with this story? Susamikshamana bunjain evatmikritam kripanka. So the mature second-class devotee is patiently expecting the Lord's mercy. It will come when the time is right. Therefore, in the meanwhile, he tolerates munjana, enjoying suffering, however you want to translate the word. That's how you feel. Whether you consider it enjoying or suffering. You tolerantly accept, experience what you know actually you've created for yourself. It's your own karma, anyway, that you're suffering and enjoying. It's not God's fault, it's our fault, whatever's happening to us now. So, it's my karma, I'm just getting the results of my past karma. I'll tolerate it. I won't, if it's what we call pleasurable. If I am given a cool bath in the summer, I consider it pleasurable. The same water, the same temperature in the middle of the winter, I consider painful. It's relative, according to my attitude and my circumstance. The same thing, I consider pleasure or pain, depending upon my attitude and circumstance. Anyway, just tolerate whatever it is, pleasurable or unpleasurable, because it's our own karma. Ridvan Vapur Bir Vidaram Namaste, and meanwhile, offering respects, homage to the Supreme Lord, obeisances with one's heart, one's words, and one's physical activities. Jiveta Yog Mukti Padesha Chadayava. One who just simply goes on living like that, not necessarily doing anything spectacular, world shattering, but just going on with his life, being patient, tolerating that whatever's happening to him is his own fault, and constantly remaining a surrendered devotee, no matter what, then he is the legal inheritor to his father's property. He is promised and guaranteed all the benefits of pure devotional service whenever Krishna is satisfied that he's ready for it. That's the definition. That's the way that a middle class devotee should think and behave. Yes. A mature devotee should be happy. He should be happy even if he gets some trouble, some physical pain or even mental pain. He should say, "That is wonderful. I'm getting my last nonsense burned out of me." But that's a mature. You could divide the phase of middle class devotee into lower and upper. So the upper class, the more advanced middle class devotee, he's happy to tolerate. And the lower class, middle class devotee, he's still struggling with it. He's unhappy. He hasn't matured enough to fully realize that what's happening to him is a cause for rejoicing. That, look, we're approaching perfection. It's just a little more suffering. We'll be done with it. Yes? Yes. Oh, yeah. And he'll understand it, but still, if he's just come into the middle class platform from the Kanishtha platform, and he's still a bit immature, then his mind will rebel sometimes. Even though we know philosophically, everything that's happening is good for our own good, but still we get annoyed by little things, right? Silly little things we get annoyed all the time. That's just a sign of our lack of maturity. To the degree that we become fixed up and our understanding becomes more full, then we put that aside. Okay, then verse 35, I'll just read that verse also. There's no comments on it. Then after departure of the Lord, the worshipful... I just read that already. Okay. He sat by Bindusarovara waiting. He just has 2 days to wait. Then verse 36. Manu syandanamastaya shaka kaumba paricharam arofya swam duhitaram sabarya payatan mahim. Now the Kshatriya is coming onto the stage. Swayambhuvalanu. Kartama was sitting in his ashram meditating. Not much to describe. We don't hear. We just said, okay, he meditated for 10,000 years. And we don't even care what happened. You know, he's thinking about something in his head. It's not much to describe. But here's the Kshatriya, Swayambhuvamanu. Swayambhuvamanu, with his wife, mounted his chariot, which was decorated with golden ornaments. Placing his daughter on it with them, he began traveling all over the earth. So here's a much more vivid picture, spectacle. Here's the king of the earth on his great chariot, gold covered with gold, and he's going with his wife and daughter. Now the first purpose of the king to go out on his chariot is to see that everything's okay all around the world, and to catch any discrepancies and deal with them. He's making a tour, but because he has another agenda, he's bringing his wife and daughter with him because he has to get his daughter married. That's his duty. Not just a king, but anybody who has a daughter. If he doesn't properly arrange for her marriage, then that's a very great discrepancy, a very serious sin. So, okay, then next verse describes what happens. Tasmin sudanvan ahani bhagavan yat samadishat upayad ashramapadam mune shanta vratasya tat. O Vidura, they reached the hermitage of the sage, who had just completed his vows of austerity on the very day foretold by the Lord. So actually, Kartama's 10,000 year vow was not exactly complete. Vishnu appeared a little bit early, so he still had 2 days of meditating to do anyway. And he finished everything he had to do in his meditating exactly on that day that Manu appeared, and it was the day that Vishnu predicted, 2 days in the future. Okay, and then verse 38 and 39.
Yasmin bhagavato nitran yapatan ashrubindavaha kripaya samparitasyat prapaner pitaya visham tadvai bindusaro nama sarasvatya pariplutam punyam shivam vitajalam maharshi ganasevitam.
The holy lake Bindusarovara, flooded by the waters of the river Sarasvati, was resorted to by hosts of eminent sages. Its holy water was not only auspicious, but as sweet as nectar. It was called Bindusarovara because drops of tears had fallen there from the eyes of the Lord, who was overwhelmed by extreme compassion for the sage who had sought his protection. This is a very sacred place where Kartama was doing his meditation. He got the name Bindusarovara after the appearance of Lord Vishnu there. It's described in the purport, or no, described in the verse here, that this is where Lord Vishnu's tears fell. And Prabhupada explains in the purport that when Vishnu saw how much trouble Kartama had taken to meditate, just to get his favor. Lord Vishnu was feeling great compassion for Kartima, and therefore he was crying. Or alternate explanation, Prabhupada gives another explanation. Of course, stop that. Is that Vishnu was very happy to see the success of his devotee, and he was crying out of pleasure. Anyway, either way. Then there's a few verses describing the auspicious beauty of the place. I could read them quickly. I'll just read the English for the next few verses. Verses 40 to 44. Just characterizing how auspicious and attractive a place this was, Bindu Sarovara. The shore of the lake was surrounded by clusters of pious trees and creepers, rich in fruits and flowers of all seasons, that afforded shelter to pious animals and birds, which uttered various cries. It was adorned by the beauty of groves of forest trees. The area was surrounded with the notes of overjoyed birds. Intoxicated bees wandered there, intoxicated peacocks proudly danced, and merry cuckoos called one another. Lake Bindu Sarovara was adorned by flowering trees such as Kadamba, Champaka, Ashoka, Karanja, Bakula, Asana Kunda, Mandara, Kutaja, and young mango trees. The air was filled with the pleasing notes of Karandava ducks, plovers, swans, ospreys, waterfowl, cranes, chakravakas, and chakuras. Prabhupada apologizes in the purport that most of these names of the birds and the trees can't be translated. And I have experience trying to look these up in dictionaries, that there aren't many English equivalents of these words. And it's not that these are unusual species, it's just that India has different species of birds that, you know, that don't occur in other parts of the world. And then verse 44. Chataiva harinai, I'll read the English. Its shores abounded with deer, boars, porcupines, gavayas, that's wild cows, elephants, baboons, lions, monkeys, mongooses, and musk deer. Okay. After that description of the beauty, then verse 45 to 47. Pavishya tatirtavaram arirajat sahatmajah tadarsha munimasinam tasmin huta hushtashanam vidyotamanam vapusha tapasyuga yujachiram natikshramam bhagavata snigdhapangavalokanat tadyaritam vitakala piyusha shravanena cha pram shum padma palakshaksham jatilam chiravasasam upasam shritya malinam yatarhanam asamskritam. Entering that most sacred spot with his daughter and going near the sage, the first monarch, Swayambhuvamanu, saw the sage sitting in his hermitage, having just propitiated the sacred fires by pouring oblations into it. His body shone most brilliantly. Though he had engaged in austere penance for a long time, he was not emaciated, for the Lord had cast his affectionate sidelong glance upon him, and he had also heard the nectar flowing from the moon-like mouth, the nectar flowing from the moon-like words of the Lord. The sage was tall. His eyes were large, like the petals of a lotus, and he had matted locks on his head. He was clad in rags. Swayambhuvamanu approached and saw him to be somewhat soiled, like an unpolished gem. So he's trying to get his daughter married, and she's a princess of the earth. You don't expect that he's going to give his daughter away to some dirty beggar. And Kardama externally looks a little bit like that. He's not dressed up to meet a king or his daughter. He's been meditating and performing sacrifices, smoke all over the place, having ghee spilled on him. Described that he's like a gem that's an unpolished gem. Prabhupada explains that when you dig very valuable jewels out of the earth, they're at first they're just rough stones. They may be covered with a crust or just, you know, not a very attractive shape, not very effulgent. They have to be cut and polished, and then they show their brilliance. So he's unpolished. He's not really presentable to the public, Kardama Muni. But the king, Swayambhu Manu, can appreciate his qualities anyway. He has the intelligence to see through the surface. Actually, Kardama is described in the verse as looking very effulgent after having offered oblations in the fire. Not because of some physical effect. Physically, he probably looks covered with soot. But having performed spiritual activity, a person naturally begins to look effulgent. Comes from the spiritual strength and the favor of the Lord. The Lord is pleased, then a person takes on an effulgent look. And still, even though he had done austerities, severe austerities for so long, he didn't look emaciated. We don't know what real austerities are like. For us, to fast for 6 hours is a great austerity. But traditionally, what yogis did was very torturous to the body. And a person would look like he had been through a lot, very, very severe self-punishment. You could see when someone had performed severe austerities. Even 500 years ago, there was the story of Jiva Goswami when when he had first come to live with his uncles, Rupa and Sanatana, in Vrindavan. He was still a young man from, you know, just from his education in Benares, expertly trained up in Vedanta and all philosophies. So not that he was proud, but the occasion happened that this Digvijayi came trying to defeat everybody, came to Vraja, and he was told that Rupa Goswami is the most learned person here, you could defeat him. And then your reputation is assured. So the Digvijayi approached Rupa Goswami, asked for a debate, and Rupa Goswami wasn't interested. He said, just give me this Jayapatra, the certificate. You've won the debate. Give it to me, I'll sign it. I don't want to waste my time debating. So Rupa Goswami acknowledged defeat without even a debate, signed the paper. But his nephew, Jiva Goswami, saw this and he became angry. And when he met outside the presence of his uncle, when he met this pundit, he told him, look, if you want a debate, I'll give you a debate. And he argued with the scholar and defeated him soundly. Some say that was Vallabhacharya. Others say no, it was somebody else. Anyway, Rupa Goswami found out that Jiva Goswami had debated and defeated this pundit, and he was dissatisfied with Jiva. You're so proud of yourself. I think better you go leave Vrindavan and go west. So Jiva Goswami took that as punishment that he had been exiled by his Shiksha Guru. And so he left Vrindavan. He didn't go very far. He crossed the Jamuna to the other side and he hid in a crocodile hole in Bilvadan, or just on the shore of the Jamuna across. From Shikata, a little bit further down. And he stayed there for several months. So when finally, it was, you know, Sanatana Goswami reminded Rupa Goswami, you know, that he should be compassionate to all the jivas. He reminded that Jiva Goswami is sitting there in exile. And they went to look for him. Nobody knew exactly where he was. And they heard about some yogi sitting in this hole, Lilavan. And when they saw him, they couldn't recognize him. Who it was, but some devotee went to find him. Couldn't recognize Jiva Goswami. He was so emaciated, probably on the verge of death, that he couldn't even recognize him. So that's what it's like when someone's performed austerity, even for a few months, real austerities, and even 500 years ago, let's speak of millions of years ago. It shows a person practically becomes unrecognizable. But Kardama, it says he wasn't even emaciated. Why? Because he had met Lord Vishnu and he got the Lord's affectionate sidelong glance and his ears were filled with the nectar of the Lord's words, and that kept his body stout and healthy. He's very tall. He has lotus eyes, large lotus eyes. Signs of a great person. These beautiful signs. Still he had matted locks. Dirty hair. Dirty, sticky hair. And he's dressed in rags. If, a Brahmin wants to have influence in the world, but he doesn't have to put on a show. He doesn't depend on charisma and popular opinion. A Brahmin wants to have influence, that his word is taken seriously. Whether he gets the prize for the most beautiful dress, the nicest dresser in the kingdom, that doesn't matter. Or whether he's the most popular with everybody. Okay, any comments, questions? You mean if a kshatriya is supposed to be a devotee also? Well, if a devotee is a kshatriya, then yes, he has to act proudly. He has to maintain a reputation. That's his responsibility. He has to be respected and even feared by the citizens. So if he doesn't keep a good reputation, a good profile, then he's not doing his job. So therefore he has to act proud. Just like a preacher. You can't just humbly give in to everything everybody says. You have to fight back if you're preaching. You have to make a bold stand. That's not really proud, but you have to act proud sometimes. Prabhupada says, a lion in the chase and a deer at home. Inside you're humble, but to do your duty, you sometimes have to act very boldly. So a pure Vaishnav king has to act like a king, which means to maintain a reputation, to be respected by the good citizens and feared by the bad citizens. You can't be negligent of that the way the Brahmin might be. But Kardama is he's acting like a Brahmin, not like a Kshatriya. Actually, these two people, Manu and Kardama, they're very similar. They're on similar levels of Krishna consciousness. They just happen to be performing different roles. They have somewhat different natures. But the difference is not that great. But once they've accepted their roles, they play them properly. Brahman has a certain way he's supposed to behave, Kshatriya has a different way. And you'll see, Manu is now going to approach Kardama. First, Kardama will talk to Manu. And then, in the next chapter, beginning of the next chapter, Manu will talk to Kardama. And what they say to each other is very important to pay attention to. What kind of attitude these two opposite members of the society, the Brahmin and Kshatriya, what they think of each other and themselves in relationship. In relationship, what a Brahmin is in human society is very much what he is in relationship to the Kshatriya. And what a Kshatriya especially, is nothing if he doesn't have a proper relationship with the Brahmins. Brahmins can live without the Kshatriyas, but Kshatriyas cannot live without the Brahmins. And if the Brahmins want to live without Kshatriyas, they have to go to the forest or the Himalayas. If they want to live with the rest of the people in ordinary society, they need the protection of the Kshatriyas. So it's very important what the relationship is between these two classes. And that mutual symbiotic relationship is what keeps the whole human society in proper order. And that's what we're missing in the modern world. Okay, we'll look at verse 48.
Atotajam upayatam nidevam pranatam puraha saparyaya paryagrihinat pratinanyanurupaya.
Seeing that the monarch had come to his hermitage and was bowing before him, the sage greeted him with benediction and received him with due honor. So this is interesting. The king has to acknowledge that the Brahmin is superior. So the first thing the king has to do is bow down to the Brahmin, not the other way around. The king may be above everybody else, and everybody bows down to the king, but not to the Kshatriya. The king does not bow down to the... Rather, the Brahmins don't bow down to the king. The king bows down to the Brahmins. Now that having been done, then the Brahmin is free to show proper respect to the king. Because although the Brahmin is basically superior to the king, still he wants to acknowledge the king's position, the king's honorable position. So he first of all gives him his blessings. The Brahmin giving blessings is not just a sentimental show. It's not just some formality. This is really where the king gains his success from, or anybody. When you get the blessings of the Brahmins, then your life is successful. The Brahmin is the teacher. When your teacher is satisfied with you, then he signs your report card, A+. When you get, when your parents receive the report card, you've got first class, top grades, then your education is complete. When the Brahmins, in other words, when the Brahmins give you their blessings, then the Supreme Lord is satisfied. Then, by the blessings of the Brahmins, all intelligence comes to you, all prosperity. That's the real basis of human society. Success doesn't come from amassing a fortune of money or great military strength. It comes from pleasing the Brahmins, who are the representatives of the Supreme Lord. When they're satisfied, then Krishna's satisfied. Of course, what satisfies the Brahmins? Real Brahmins are not satisfied by bribes, by bhakshis, by charity, money in their pocket, cross my palm with silver and I'll give you a blessing. The proper Brahmins are satisfied when they're able to impart the Vedic knowledge and people hear and accept it. When they can give the instructions of the Supreme Lord as they understand them, and people hear, and people put it, into action in their lives, then the Brahmins are satisfied and give their blessings. My dear boy, you've heard the instructions nicely. You're a sincere student, therefore I give you my blessings. Modern Hindu society is completely misunderstood. They think the sadhus are blessing machines. Touch their feet, throw some coins at them, and you'll get some blessings on your head, and you'll get all sorts of benefits. That's a good business deal. So there's a story that hearsay, I don't know what, I can't cite the shastra that it's written in, but Prabhupada was traveling on a train somewhere in South India, Tamal Krishna Maharaj and some other sannyasi. And there were some young students, southern Indian students, who wanted to get Prabhupada's audience. So they were sticking their head in the bogey, trying to get in, or trying to get Prabhupada's attention. They knew if Prabhupada saw them and acknowledged them, then he'd invite them in. So Tamal Krishna Maharaj was shooing them away, trying to keep them away from the door, not to let Prabhupada see them. Finally, they got Prabhupada's attention, and he invited them in to the car. And he said, "What can I do for you?" And he said, "Oh, Swamiji, we just want your blessings." So Prabhupada very quickly got to the point and said, "Look at these disciples, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, the other devotee there." He said, "This is my blessings. You become like them. You shave your head, become disciples." Anyway, that got rid of them very quickly. And they said, "Okay, thank you, Swamiji," and they ran away. That's blessings of the Guru. Blessings of the Brahmins. Take their instructions. And that's what they give blessings when they're satisfied. And the pure Brahmins feel they've done their work when someone hears them, hears their instructions, and accepts them. Then they're satisfied to give their blessings. Not, the kind of blessings you can buy for 10 rupees. So that's what's happening here. Manu approaches, offers his obeisances, and even without a word being said, Kardama appreciates very much the attitude. Here is the king of the earth, and I'm just some beggar in rags sitting here in my ashram. He's bowing down to me. Oh, very nice. I offer you whatever blessings I have to give, I offer them to you. And then, this is the king. I'm also a citizen. I may be a Brahmin, but still, I have to offer the. I don't, bow down to him, but I offer him a seat. I offer him some water. Whatever facility I have for hospitality in my humble ashram, I have to offer it to the king and acknowledge, oh, yes. It's a great privilege to have you here as our guest. So that's what he does third. But the third thing that happens is that he received him with due honor, according to his means, according to his capacity. The Brahmin is superior to the Kshatriya, but still the king deserves due honor also, always. So that's described again in the Shatapatha Brahmana, again the sixth chapter, which describes actually the Rajasuya sacrifice. So in the Rajasuya sacrifice, there's a statement. Well, the context is, it's describing how the Brahmin in the Rajasuya sacrifice has to worship the king. And he sits on a lower seat for that particular worship. Usually Brahmin sits on a higher seat. But when it's time to worship the king, in the sacrifice, then the Brahmin sits on the lower seat. The statement is, Kshatrat param nasti tasmad brahmana kshatriyam adastat upaste rajasuye. No one is greater than the Kshatriya. Thus in the Rajasuya sacrifice, the Brahmin worships the Kshatriya from a lower seat. Another statement in the same chapter, the Shatapatha Brahmana. Kshatriyam pratamam yantam itare trayo varna paschat anuyanti. Also in the same sacrifice, when the procession is a procession, the king goes first, and all the other three varnas, including the Brahmins, follow behind him. So the king, in situations, he gets the proper honor. Why is that? The philosophical understanding is, let the kings take all the worldly honor. Let them get the respect of the people. Let them take all the wealth. Let them enjoy all the opulence and the sense gratification. Brahmins aren't interested in that anyway, real Brahmins. So the king can have all the respect of the citizens. He can be worshipped and given everything. The Brahmins, they want to be honored. They want to be influential. And they want their influence to be acknowledged. But the form it takes is not in their being worshipped or showered with sense gratification. Brahmins don't want that. They simply want that the words that they're speaking be listened to. That's all. When everybody else listens to what they have to say, then the Brahmins are satisfied. They feel that they've been honored. Real Brahmin. The proper attitude of Brahmin. So the king, he can, you know, march first in the parade, he can sit on a big throne. Brahmins aren't interested in that anyway. Okay, any comments? Verse 49. Of course, these are the ideals. This is the way, you know, in the real world we find all sorts of corrupt Brahmins and Kshatriyas, but proper Brahmin, proper Kshatriya, this is the way they're supposed to be. No? Okay, text 49.
Grihit varhanavasinam samyatam prinayan munihi smaran bhagavadadesham ityaha shlakshnaya gira.
After receiving the sage's attention, the king sat down and was silent. Recalling the instructions of the Lord, Kardama then spoke to the king as follows, delighting him with his sweet accents. Okay, so the king at first, he bowed down, he didn't say anything. The Brahmin is the guru. So coming, the king approaching the Brahmin has to take the position of a disciple. His business is first to listen. He can respond, but first he remain quiet and listen. So he didn't speak first. Although he's the one coming to Kardama with some business. Kardama didn't approach him. He's approaching Kardama. Still, he didn't say anything at first. That's proper. First, let me receive some instruction. Let me see what this Brahmin has to say. Then I'll address my business after he talks first. And then Kardama, he didn't just open up his mouth without thinking either. First, he thought carefully and remembered the Lord's instructions. Before speaking, a Brahmin, before doing anything, a Brahmin thinks first. What is Tasmat Shastram Pramavante Karya Karya Vivastitam? You may not have talked to God 2 days before. You may not have direct personal instructions. But the Brahmins always have the instructions of God in the form of the Shastra. Krishna says at the end of the 17th chapter, 16th chapter, Tasmat Shastram Pramanam Te. You should always consider the scripture, your authority, and all matters, all questions of what to do and what not to do. Don't just act on impulse. Don't trust your own intelligence. Always think before you do or say anything. What does the scripture say about this? That's how a Brahmin behaves. You know, he's careful before he says or does anything. He always makes sure that it's in line with the injunctions of scripture. Or in the case of Kardama, he has direct personal instructions of the Supreme Lord. So before, although it's the cue, he's given the cue, okay, he's supposed to speak first. The king isn't saying anything. But before he speaks, he also remembers, okay, what was it that Bhishma told me? And then he addresses Manu with sweet words, trying to please him. A noble person, Brahmin or Kshatriya, tries to please everybody he deals with. This is important. It's not just politics or flattery or trying to keep people out of your way by being nice to them. But the superior person should be kind to the inferior people. These other people are suffering in confusion and material attachment. We should, you know, they're like children. So dealing with children, you shouldn't be unnecessarily harsh with them. They're just children. They don't know. So therefore it's natural. The noble, superior person should be kind in his dealings with everybody. So therefore, Kardama is addressing Manu, out of respect also, very politely. Okay, so now we're up to verse 50. Kardama now addresses Manu. Here's how a Brahmin should deal with a Kshatriya.
Nunam Changramanam Deva satam samrakshanayate vadaya cha satam yastvam hare shaktir pipalini.
The tour you have undertaken, O Lord, is surely intended to protect the virtuous and kill the demons, since you embody the protecting energy of Sri Hari. First thought is that you are a representative of God. The king is a representative of Lord Vishnu, especially representative of the personification of the protecting potency of Lord Vishnu. Just like Krishna appears in this world to protect the devotees and kill the demons, he's saying the same thing about the king here. Here you are, you're on tour, you're sitting on your chariot. First thought is, you're out here to protect the virtuous and to kill the demons. Just like Krishna himself. So therefore the Brahman is thinking of the Kshatriya as power, like a vibhuti, opulent expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Okay, first, any comment on that? First qualification, or the first important function of the Kshatriya, is to protect. Kshatriya has to protect the citizens. He uses force, he takes taxes, so he takes power in his hands, he takes money in his hands, wealth in his hands, but it's for the purpose of protecting the citizens. If he fails to protect the citizens, both physically and spiritually, that means to see the principles of religion are properly maintained in the kingdom, as well as to see that, you know, there's no invasion of enemies, that the criminals are not allowed to do nonsense, but also to see that principles, everybody does their varnashram duty properly. If he fails to provide that protection, then he has no right to take any taxes, he has no right to have his position. He's a nonsense and he'll go to hell. That's stated very, very emphatically in the Dharma Shastras, the Manasam Samhita. The king who accepts 1/6 of everybody's income as tax, if he does his duty, if he gives protection, then he gets 1/6 of everybody's pious credits. But if he doesn't provide perfect protection, if he doesn't punish the evildoers, then he gets 1/6 of everybody's sinful reactions. And that will drag him to hell, surely. Especially if he fails to do his duty, the kingdom will be unruly, and there'll be plenty of sinful reactions, and he gets 1/6 of all of them. He'll spend a long time in hell. Okay. Anything? Text 51.
Yorkendvagnindravayunam yama dharma prachetasam rupani stana adatse tasmai shuklaya te namaha.
You assume when necessary the part of the sun god, the moon god, Agni, the god of fire, Indra, the lord of paradise, Vayu, the wind god, Yama, the god of punishment, Dharma, the god of piety, and Varuna, the god presiding over the waters. All obeisances to you, who are none other than Lord Vishnu. So we have a sort of bias in ISKCON that demigods are nobody, useless. Actually, the demigods are glorified throughout the Vedas. The Vedas are all prayers addressed to demigods, not to Krishna mostly. Krishna's mentioned very, once or twice in all the Vedas. But Indra is glorified constantly, and these other demigods that are mentioned here, they're all glorified in the Vedas. Because, the Acharyas explain, the commentators of the Vedas, the demigods are the representatives of the Supreme Lord. They're like the parts of his body, his specific energies. Indra is the ruling power of God. He represents the arm of the universal form. Indra comes from the arm of the universal form. And each of the demigods represent different powers of God. So, and it's even explained. I don't remember where the statement is. Krishna says that in the beginning of creation, I give my own forms and names and functions to the demigods on loan. The names of the demigods are really my names. Their functions and even their appearances are really borrowed from me. So, when we talk about the king embodying all the demigods, that means he's embodying the personal energies of the Supreme Lord. Each of these demigods, Surya, Agni, Indra, Vayu, Yama, they're all different partial aspects of the Supreme Personality, especially the aspects that create and rule the universe. And then he says at the very end, Tasmai Shuklaya Tevnama. Thus, since you are all the embodiment, all these demigods are embodied in you, the king, therefore you're actually Vishnu. Sum total of the demigods, that means Vishnu, the Supreme Person. Shukla, the all auspicious transcendental Lord. Okay. Then the next three verses together, 52 to 54, he describes in more detail the function of the king, especially in respect to maintaining the principles of religion. First, he mentioned in the beginning, you come and you protect this pious and you kill the demons. Well, the third function of God in descending to this world is to maintain the principle or reestablish the principles of religion. And the king also, as representative of the Supreme Lord, does that also. So that's described here, the maintaining of religious principles.
Na yada ratamastaya jaitram maniganarpitam vispurja chandako dando ratena trasayan agan swasainya charana kshunnam vepayan mandalam bubahap Vikarshan Brihatim Senam Paryatasyam Shumaniva Tadaiva Setavak Sarve Varnashrama Nibandanaha Bhagavad Vachita Rajan Vidyeran Batadasyubihi.
If you did not mount your victorious jeweled chariot, whose mere presence threatens culprits, if you did not produce fierce sounds by the twanging of your bow, and if you did not roam about the world like the brilliant sun, leading a huge army whose trampling feet causes the globe of the earth to tremble, then all the moral laws governing the varnas and ashrams created by the Lord Himself would be broken by the rogues and rascals. So Karnava, he's a simple Brahmin sage. He's not interested in joining any armies that are trampling the earth or riding on a chariot. There's no personal interest to him. But he's very interested. The king who is taking the trouble to do all this, to lead armies and ride on his chariot to victory, he's protecting the principles of religion. He's protecting the citizens from the bad influences of rogues and rascals. All the moral laws of the varnas and ashrams that were created by the Lord Himself would be broken if you didn't lead your army to victory, if you didn't use violence when necessary to punish those who refuse to obey those principles of varna and ashram. And then he says in the next verse, since we're out of time, I'll just read the next verse. I'll just read the English. If you gave up all thought of the world's situation, unrighteousness would flourish, for men who hanker only after money would be unopposed. Such miscreants would attack, and the world would punish. But the world would perish. Would perish. And then last verse. In spite of all this, I ask you, O valiant king, the purpose for which you have come here, whatever it may be, we shall carry it out without reservation. So greedy men would be unopposed if the king didn't maintain a strong position, maintain his reputation, and at least always have the threat of punishment for anyone who did nonsense. Maybe he doesn't have to use violence, but at least he has to always be, you know, threatening to use violence. Still, he's wondering, okay, fine, you're doing your job, very nice, but what did you come here for? What business do you have in my little ashram? So then he asks, okay, but you must have some special purpose for coming to me. Whatever it is, I'll be glad to do whatever you ask me. Charitable attitude. Maybe he's going to ask him to join his army or become prime minister. He offers, whatever you want me to do. You're the king, I'm your humble servant, just ask me what you want. Yeah, I'll be done with it. Yes, Prabhu. Maybe not. We're not told that he was told what's happening. We don't know. I mean, according to what we're told here, is just as Swayambhu Mahadev got on his chariot, started wandering the earth, and he just happened to come to Bindusarovara. You know, maybe there's an untold part of the story. Yes? No, he intended to get it. I'm sorry, he intended to get his daughter married, but we're not told that he had any inkling that this is where he's going to find the right man. Yeah. Maybe there's a part of the story we're not told here. Somebody, maybe Lord Vishnu himself or somebody, maybe told him, but we don't know that. Yes, ma'am? A king shouldn't force a Brahmin into government service. He can invite him into government service. A king needs the guidance of the Brahmins. So, you know, he wants to get good advisors. And sometimes it's recommended by Manu, if you can get a Brahmin to be your prime minister, that's the best person to do his job, a Brahmin. So sometimes the Brahmins were the prime ministers, or even the, you know, the military advisors. But not, you know, to force the Brahmin into government service is not proper. Yeah. Of course, we have like Nawab Hussain Shah, but he was a Vlecha Yavana. And he forced Rupan Sanata into government service. But that's not, a Kshatriya should deal like that with Brahmins. We have to beg the Brahmins, please help us. We need help. Please help. Give us some advice. King has no power. Constitutional Kshatriya doesn't have the power to force the Brahmins to do anything. Yes.